This is the WGBH Forum Network.
Good evening, everyone. I'm Bill Fowler, the director of the Massachusetts Historical Society, and welcome to the Cambridge Forum with David McCullough discussing 1776. Is there a literate citizen in our republic who does not know David McCullough? He's been into your living room via the American Experience and the Civil War. He has received two Pulitzer Prizes with Truman and John Adams, and has twice received the National Book Award for Path Between the Seas and Mornings on Horseback. His other widely acclaimed books include Brave Companions, The Great Bridge, The Johnstown Flood. None of his books have ever been out of print. For his work overall, he has been honored with the National Book Foundation Distinguished Contribution to American Letters, the National Humanities Medal, the St. Louis Literary Award, the Carl Sandburg Award, the New York Public Library's Literary Lion Award. He has received 31 honorary degrees, addressed a joint session of the United States Congress, and spoken at the White House. But there is something else about David McCullough, something that is very special. In addition to his work as an historian, David McCullough is a great patriot and a great teacher. His love for America has been chronicled so many times. He has reminded us in his books that in times of crisis in our history, that integrity, loyalty, determination, perseverance, and love can bring us through the crisis. In our difficult times today, where such virtues often seem rather scarce, he restoreth our faith in America. His newest book, 1776, grew out of his work on John Adams, and it tells the story of the American Revolution as experienced by George Washington and the men who marched with him, as well as loyalists and Hessian mercenaries, politicians, preachers, traitors, and spies, men and women of all kinds caught in the path of war. The year 1776 was the first year of sustained revolutionary struggle. It was a difficult year with suffering and discouragement and too few victories and too many defeats. And here this evening to bring that year alive for all of us, David McCullough.
Thank you, and thank you, Bill. Bill is the, as he said, the director of the Massachusetts Historical Society. And at risk of telling some of you what you already know, I would like to remind you and inform the others that the Massachusetts Historical Society is the greatest collection of manuscript papers, American manuscript papers, letters, diaries, and the like, anywhere in the country except for the Library of Congress. And it is, in effect, the presidential library of three presidents, two Adams and Thomas Jefferson. Many people wonder, how can it be that Jefferson's papers are there? Well, he left his papers to a favorite granddaughter who married a Massachusetts man, and hence they came here. And it drives those Virginians crazy. I spent many of the happiest days of my life in the last 10 years working on my new book and on John Adams at the Massachusetts Historical Society. In fact, the first third of this book, which in many ways is part of the book I'm proudest of, because virtually nothing has been written about the Siege of Boston for more than 70 years. And it's a rich story, a very important story, a very revealing story about some of the most important people in the whole course of the American Revolution. But virtually all of the research for that was done at the Massachusetts Historical Society. And some of the most valuable of all the diaries are there, including the diary of Henry Knox, which, among other things, chronicles his extraordinary trek in bringing the guns back from Ticonderoga back to Boston in the midst of winter, one of the epic, almost mythic events of the war, and one of the most important. So to have Bill Fowler, who is a very dear friend and the head of the Massachusetts Historical Society, introduce me tonight in this historic church, in this town especially, is for me a very high point in my writing and professional life, and I thank you, Bill, from the bottom of my heart. I'm also proud to tell you, pleased to tell you, that my editor-in-chief is here tonight. I insisted that she be here. She is my wife, my partner. She's, well, we have a large family, 5 children, 17 grandchildren, and she's mission control and Secretary of the Treasury and Chair of the Ethics Committee. Rosalie, would you stand up, please? Thank you. She really is the editor-in-chief. She's helped me with my work and helped me keep my head down and my courage up since I first resigned my day job to try and see if I could make it on my own writing history. And when John Adams won the Pulitzer Prize, we got the word on April 8th, which is Rosalie's birthday, and everybody in the family thought that was entirely appropriate. You know, when you hear that you won the Pulitzer Prize, it isn't like those commercials on for Publishers Clearinghouse. What happens is the phone rings and a reporter, in this case it was Hillel Attali for the AP, asks if you are you, and you say you are, and he said, are you aware that you've just won the Pulitzer Prize? And of course you're not, and then he asks you how you feel, and you have no idea. And the next call came from Bob Hoover, who writes for the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette. Pittsburgh is my hometown, and after that it was David Mohegan from The Globe, and then USA Today, and National Public Radio, and so forth. And friends either heard it on the radio or something would start calling, and our two daughters were there with their children, so we all already have sort of a full house and feeling festive. And our oldest daughter counted 50 phone calls by the time the day was ending. But it was only about 8 o'clock or so, maybe a little after, when we finally, the house was quite peaceful and quiet, and we settled down to a quiet family dinner, at which point at about 8:15 the phone rang again, and Rosalie got up and went to answer it, and we heard her say, yes, well, yes, I don't know, but let me see, just a minute, please. And she covered the phone with her hand and said, it's Christine Maxwell from the Christian Science Monitor. Are you willing to talk to her? And I said, sure. So I got up and went into the living room and picked up the phone and said hello. And she said, Mr. McCullough. I said, yes. She said, this is Christine Maxwell from the Christian Science Monitor. And I said, yes. And she said, are you aware of our special 23-week trial subscription? One of the hardest things, it seems to me, to convey in teaching history or writing history, and one of the most important to convey, is that nothing ever had to happen the way it happened. We're so often presented history as this following this following that, and we're meant to get that straight because it will be on the test on Wednesday. And we begin to think after a good many years of that process that that had to be that way. And it never did. Events of all kinds could have gone off in any number of different directions, excuse me, for any number of different reasons, anywhere along the line, just as in our own lives. The other point I would like to make is that if you think about it, nothing ever really happened in the past. Nobody ever lived in the past. They lived in the present. It was their present and different from ours, and that's important, how different it was. But they lived in the present. Washington, Jefferson, Adams, they didn't walk around saying, isn't this fascinating, living in the past? Aren't we quaint in our funny clothes? And they didn't know how things were going to turn out. I don't think one can overemphasize how important that is. They don't know how it's going to turn out. They don't know what happens in the long run any more than we do. And it's often very easy to look at it from our vantage point, the present, our present, and say, well, why didn't they do this? Or they should have done that, or those people shouldn't have given up what they did, and so forth and so on. And that's, to a large extent, the hubris of the present, that somehow we are superior. Somehow we know so much more than those poor folks back there living in that poorly lighted time. In many ways, I think the more one involves oneself in that other time, the more one comes to conclude that in many ways they were superior to us. They were strong people, and they were used to hardship, used to hard work, used to the fear of epidemic disease, the fear of the unknown, because so much about the epidemic disease then was unknown. What caused it? When will it go away? The inevitable inconveniences and discomforts of that time that we don't know at all. Even in peacetime, life was a struggle. And particularly in New England. One grew up in New England learning from experience to expect the worst. So when we read about what hardships the soldiers who fought in the Revolutionary War endured, we shouldn't by any means say, well, they didn't mind it too much. Of course, they suffered terribly, but they were very tough people. And soldiers and farmers know about weather. And soldiers and farmers are who we're talking about, since almost all of soldiers were farmers. One of the most poignant lines of all the letters that I've worked with over the last 10 years is from Abigail Adams, written that same summer of 1776 to her husband, who was off in Philadelphia serving in the Continental Congress. Posterity, who are to reap the blessings, will scarcely be able to conceive the hardships and sufferings of their ancestors. She knew it then, and she, alas, was right. We don't know what they went through. 1776 was the most important year of the most important conflict in our history, the Revolutionary War. Without the Revolutionary War, there would be no United States of America. The Revolutionary War, furthermore, was the longest war in our history, except for Vietnam, 8.5 years. And it was the bloodiest war in our history, except for the Civil War. 25,000 Americans lost their lives. Now, that doesn't seem like very much by our terms, but by their terms, it was catastrophic. 1% of the population, 2,500,000 people in all of the 13 colonies. Were we fighting such a war today, we would lose over 3 million people, to give you some idea of what they sacrificed. And of course, the dead are not the only sacrifice, nor were the soldiers who marched with Washington the only people who suffered. But suffer they did. nor did it look very encouraging, ever. There was a night in the winter of 1776, early in 1776, just up the way here on Brattle Street at what we call the Longfellow House, which was Washington's headquarters, and ought to be so understood as to be that as well as the Longfellow House, when Washington was tossing and turning at night, unable to sleep, as he recorded in a letter. "The reflection upon my situation and that of this army produces many an uneasy hour when all around me are wrapped in sleep. Few people know the predicament we are in." So it isn't just that we don't know today what they suffered then, what they went through then, how bleak, how dark, how in many ways hopeless it appeared, but he's saying that few people then knew. Now, who were they? Well, we have a pretty good idea who George Washington was. But in my view, we need to know more. He's not the marble man. He's not unapproachable. He's not aloof or arrogant or unkind or stuffy. He's a leader. That's foremost. He isn't an intellectual like John Adams or Jefferson. He isn't a great strategist or tactician like Napoleon. He isn't a passionate, persuasive speaker like Patrick Henry. He's a leader. He has absolute integrity. He has, for lack of any better word that I know, character. He has phenomenal courage, which is the first thing required in a leader because everything else depends on that. And it's both physical and moral courage. He is steadfast. He will not quit. And he never loses sight of what the war is about. And he conveys this courage and self-control and dedication to the glorious cause of America, as they called it, in such a way that others feel deeply his feelings and will follow him through hell. Now, not all of them did, by any means. Not all of them were heroes. They deserted in droves by the hundreds. Many, when their enlistments were up, marched right off to home as fast as they could go, by the thousands, both from here and later on in December, when Washington was retreating across New Jersey and couldn't spare a man, let alone 2,000 of his men, who just walked away with no shame whatsoever when they were most desperately needed. And many went over to the enemy. We mustn't forget that. Hundreds of them went over to the enemy, right here. Just as many of the enemy came over to our side. There was a lot of back and forthing, often depending whether there was food enough keep them going, or clothes enough to keep them warm. British sentries froze to death here around Boston in that winter. The only losses, the only American fatalities during the attack at Trenton were two men on the 9-mile march after they had crossed the Delaware, on the 9-mile march down to Trenton to hit Trenton the next morning, who died on the march because they froze to death. And yes, they did, many of them have no shoes, and yes, they did leave bloody footprints in the snow. All true. But George Washington was also a man who, when these awful nights came down on him, and there were many of them far worse than those he suffered here in Cambridge, who would sit down and write long, long letters back to his home at Mount Vernon to tell the people there how he wanted the wainscoting done of the new addition to the house, what color paint he wanted used, what sort of siding should be on the new kitchen. You read them and you think, wait a minute, what's going on? And they're extensive letters, and every detail is important to him. And then I thought of something that happened during the Second World War when Eisenhower was given command of D-Day and he went to London to take over in the headquarters on Grosvenor Square Churchill said to him, Ike, you've got to find something to do, something to think about, a hobby other than your work, because the burdens you're going to be under are going to be so enormous that without some sort of diversion, you will crack. And he urged Eisenhower to take up painting, which Eisenhower did. Churchill said, it's helped me a great deal, and I think you'll like it. Well, Eisenhower loved it. He became pretty good at it, not as good as Churchill, who was superb. But I think that Washington's imaginary leap from the winter of 76 here in Cambridge, or the winter, the December at the end of 76, retreating across New Jersey, I think that that was for him what the painting was for Churchill and Eisenhower. It helped him to keep from cracking. He bore a burden of gloom and doom such as I don't know of any man carrying in such a position of tremendous responsibility. His health was phenomenal. While people all around him, virtually everyone, was getting sick with something or other, he never was ill once that we know of in that year. This is also true of Henry Knox. Henry Knox was a Boston bookseller, a great, big, fat, gregarious young man that everybody liked and who was impossible to ignore. He had the idea to go to Ticonderoga and bring back the guns left there after Ethan Allen and his Green Mountain boys had captured the fort in May of the early of 1775. The guns were still there, but Fort Ticonderoga was over 300 miles away in upstate New York, and he proposed to do this in the midst of winter, and he did it. Now, what's so interesting is that Henry Knox was 25 years old. Henry Knox knew no more about the military or artillery than what he'd read in books, nor did Nathaniel Greene from Rhode Island, who was all of 33 when they made him a general, knew no more about the military or being in the army or fighting a war than what he'd read in books. But you see, that was an age when people believed that reading books wasn't a bad way to learn things. That's the spirit of the Enlightenment, the faith of the Enlightenment, vividly personified by these two men who, like Washington, had no formal schooling beyond about fifth grade, but who never stopped reading. And of course, it was a young man's war, a young woman's war, a young cause. Washington was 43 when he took command here in Cambridge. We see the old fellow in his white powdered hair and the awkward teeth, the founding father, the elder statesman. He wasn't that yet, not for a very long time to come. And he was the oldest of them. Jefferson was 33 when he wrote the Declaration of Independence, 33 years old. Benjamin Rush, who in many ways is one of the most interesting of them all, the famous physician of that time who was the first to urge that people with mental illness be treated humanely. Benjamin Rush was all of 30 years old when he signed the Declaration of Independence. They're young, they're inexperienced. They've never fought a revolution. No people had ever successfully revolted against the mother country. This country had no army, it had no navy, it had no money, and it had no prior experience. There was no Che Guevara who'd done it before somewhere else. And they'd never founded a country. And they're all coming out of this tiny population of 2,500,000 people, 500,000 of whom, as you might recall, were held in bondage as slaves, black men, women and children. And of course, there is the glaring incongruity that many of them were themselves slave masters, including George Washington. They postponed that issue, as they would postpone that issue again with the Constitution. All men are created equal. Life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. To what extent did the Declaration of Independence inspire these soldiers? very hard to know for certain. It's absolutely inspired people like Nathaniel Green and Henry Knox. It certainly was a powerful morale moment when Washington ordered that the Declaration of Independence be read aloud to everybody in New York, all of the army in New York, when the document itself reached New York in its full text. And when that happened, I want to read you what Nathaniel Green said. Excuse me, I want to, if I can find it. I want to tell you, that what happened was that Knox said, "Now, how we play our parts will affect generations and generations to come." That's an extremely important observation, because Knox is saying how we play our parts, and this idea that they are cast in roles unlike anybody has ever been cast before. In one of the great dramatic turning points in history, permeates all that they say. Washington, Adams, Knox, Green, all of them. Except when you get down in the ranks, you don't read that much. There is no mention that I know of in the memoir of Joseph Plum Martin, a 16-year-old Army volunteer, soldier, foot soldier, who wrote a wonderful memoir later. There's no mention of it in the diaries of Jabez Fitch, another Connecticut farmer with 8 children. No mention of the Declaration of Independence that I know of in the papers of my favorite Joseph Hodgkins, who was a cobbler from Ipswich. They may have indeed been fighting for the Declaration of Independence and its noble ideals, but they don't talk about it much. They talk about winning. They talk about surviving till the next day. They talk about doing their part, and they talk again and again about the glorious cause of America. Now, keep in mind that when the soldiers who went out to face the British redcoats at Lexington and Concord leveled their muskets on the enemy, they were not fighting for independence, nor were they doing so at Bunker Hill. They were fighting, in their view, in their hearts and minds, for their rights as freeborn Englishmen. It is only in 1776 when this idea of independence takes hold, and it's only after the text of a speech given by the King of England before Parliament in October arrives here in Boston, in Cambridge, on the very first day of the new year, January 1, 1776. And word of that text, of that speech, spread through this town, spread through Boston like wildfire, and out into the countryside. Because the king had said that the Americans are in rebellion, and that their leaders are traitors, and that we are going to crush that rebellion. In other words, it wasn't just going to be a brief family squabble. Washington wrote his wife, Martha, that he would be home by Christmas. That thought all passed by the way on the first day of January 1776. When one finishes reading about this year, when you live inside the diaries and letters of the people who were there, who saw it, who fought it, who survived it, you come away with several very powerful feelings that I think, for me at least, will stay with me for the rest of my life. One is that they did everything for us. Because the words of the Declaration of Independence would have been just that, words on paper, had it not been for them. That when we celebrate the 4th of July, we shouldn't just be celebrating those noble ideals. That's important, for sure. We shouldn't just be imagining the 1776 of the Broadway show. All those eminent leaders in their magnificent 18th century attire, parading around on stage like somebody in a costume pageant. That was part of it, and a very important part. But there are these other people, mostly long forgotten, but by no means have their traces been eliminated. They are there. We can read what happened. We can hear their voices in their own words. If our satisfaction with ourselves, if our abundance and our amplitude of opportunities are so hypnotizing to us that we forget about those people and we take what we have for granted, what kind of a country are we? We profess we love our country. What would somebody who professes to love another man or another woman or your father or your mother, but knows nothing about them, what kind of love would that be? We are a very interesting country, and the shame of it is that so few people know much about it. Now, I don't think we ought to read history and read about the Revolutionary War, read about any period that fascinates you or others, because it's necessarily going to make us more grateful for what we have, it will, or that it will make us a better citizen, it will, or that it will help us to understand human nature far better than almost anything else one could study, and it will, but also as a source of pleasure. You couldn't invent a novel that would have such incredible events that take place as in this year, 1776. You read what happened and you say, that just doesn't happen in real life. But it did. When time and again, the weather, literally which way the wind was blowing, would determine the outcome, not just of one battle or one engagement, but of the war. If the wind had been in a different direction the night of August 29th, 1776, on the East River in New York, I think it would have been all over, because it would have taken only the British fleet to come up into the East River and seal off any possible escape by Washington and the Army from Brooklyn Heights. They would have had them right in the bag, exactly the same way we had the British in the bag at Yorktown when the French fleet arrived at exactly the right time to seal off any retreat there, one of the great ironies of the war. There's one point when Continental Army is retreating across New Jersey, when all they have left are 3,000 men, probably a fourth of whom are sick, most of them have no winter clothing. They've done nothing but lose and lose and lose again for months. 3,000 men and the whole future of the country and all that the Declaration embodied was riding on those people. So what Washington did when all hope was lost is what we often have to do when all hope is lost. He attacked. He came across the Delaware, struck at Trenton, and history changed because we had beaten them. It wasn't a big battle. It wasn't a grand European-style conflict. But it changed history because it changed what was in people's hearts, their morale, their attitude. And then he struck a few days later in the first week of 1777 at Princeton and won again. I've been at this now for 40 years, and I've been very fortunate in my subjects. And I've loved the work I've done on every book I've written. But I have never enjoyed so much what I've been doing as working in the 18th century. Bill and I were talking about this backstage before the evening began. There's something about those people. Something about those people from whom we can learn more than we have any idea, and how fortunate we are that they did what they did. That's my talk.
Thank you very much, David. This is the Cambridge Forum with David McCullough, speaking about his book, 1776. David, you've been a very powerful voice for American history, and you've traveled around America extensively. I wonder if you have any comments that you might wish to share with us about the teaching of American history in our schools today.
Well, we've got a big job to do. We're raising several generations of young Americans who are, by and large, historically illiterate. And it's very apparent on the campuses of the best colleges and universities in the country, including the one across the street. And it can be discouraging, but I think some progress is being made. First of all, I feel strongly that we need to revise how we're teaching our teachers. We ought to do away with schools of education and degrees in education. We ought to have teachers graduating with a good liberal arts education with a major in a real subject, not just history, but all the other subjects. It's a terrible thing to turn a young person loose to teach history or botany or physics or whatever it is, not knowing anything about it. And it happens all over the country every year. 80% of the teachers teaching history in our schools and colleges, in our colleges nationwide, did not have any history in college. And that's important, but for two reasons. First, beyond the obvious reason, it's hard to teach something that you don't know anything about. The second is that you can't love something you don't know anything about. You can't love someone you don't know. You can't love a subject you don't know anything about. And you know from your own experience, the best teachers, the most effective teachers, the teachers that really can change your life, are the teachers who love what they're teaching. The second thing is that if you don't know what you're teaching, you become much more dependent on the textbooks. And in the field of history, the textbooks, with only a few exceptions in my view, are dreary in the extreme. They are really deadly. Sometimes I feel that they were written with this particular intent of killing any interest that anyone might have in history. There are wonderful people teaching history today, all over the country. But alas, they are fewer and fewer in number. Furthermore, I think teachers are the most important people in our society, by far. I don't think there's anyone doing more important work than teachers. It is the greatest of all professions, in my view. And we've got to get over the idea that too many people have, that the teachers are sort of glorified babysitters who look after our children or grandchildren while we're off doing the important work. They are doing the important work. But my strongest message, if that's proper, is something I've learned from one of my daughters. Her name is Dori Lawson, and last year she published a book called Posterity, The Letters of Great Americans to Their Children. And in the process of writing that book, she read thousands of letters from prominent Americans to their children, all the way from the 17th century down to the present. And she learned so much from how those interesting and often brilliant people related to their children or coached their children or talked with their children through the medium of a letter. And the more she thought about the problems of teaching history today, the more she came to the conclusion that the problem with education in our country today is us. That we have to be talking about history with our children and grandchildren. We have to bring up the subject of history or a favorite period in history or a favorite figure in history at the dinner table. Bring back the dinner table conversation. Bring back dinner. And I know in my own experience, now granted, a very different generation, but our family sat down to dinner every night promptly at 6:30, and the talk began at once. And it was often about events during the day, or it was often my father asking a question or my mother taking up some subject that interested her, often politics, and very often history. My grandmother, my mother's mother, Mabel Rankin, thought that Franklin Roosevelt could walk on water. She thought he was the greatest human being that, second greatest human being that ever lived. And my father thought that Franklin Roosevelt was the worst thing that ever happened to this country. And they would go to it. And what made those discussions so memorable is that both of them were exceedingly hard of hearing. So with a decibel level alone, I know all about the New Deal. We have to take our children, our grandchildren, to historic sites. Take them to right up Brattle Street to Washington's headquarters, to the Longfellow House, and get Jim Shea, who runs that wonderful historic site, to show you around. I think Jim might be here tonight. Jim, are you here? There he is. Stand up. Go see Jim Shea. Go to the Longfellow House. Walk into what was Washington's study, the fireplace there, and imagine who was in that room. Benjamin Franklin, John Adams, Abigail Adams. That's where Washington met with his generals to decide whether or not to attack the British in Boston. That's where he met with Henry Knox to send him on that far-flung venture off to Ticonderoga. If those old walls could speak, they could tell you more than you could ever imagine. But it isn't hard to imagine. Take them to Concord and Lexington. Take them to Gettysburg. Take them to Monticello and Mount Vernon. That's the way to do it. And it will give us all something more to talk about just than sports or what was on television. Now, people right away say, oh, but we haven't any time to do that. You don't understand. I understand. The average family today watches 3 to 4 hours of television every single day. Turn it off, go out and do something beneficial and interesting.
Ladies and gentlemen, I think now the floor is yours, and Mr. McCullough is willing to take some questions. May I ask again, as was mentioned earlier, please come to the microphone, and do please ask a question.
In your remarks, you've stressed integrity of the leadership as one of the prime requisites. I'm sure as you write and delve into the history that you make comparisons between yesterday and today. I wonder if you'd share them with us.
Yes. Did you all hear the question? How would you, studying integrity in the figures that I've been writing about, I must also have taken into consideration people in political or high office today, and how would I strike a comparison? I think that George Washington was the greatest president in our history because he was a unifying figure both through the war and as president. He was exactly the right man for his times. And I think that we, among the miracles of 1776, among the miracles that made possible our whole way of life, is the fact that there, at the very beginning, we had a man of that kind. Now, exceptional presidents are the exception. And we shouldn't expect, nor has history illustrated, that great presidents come along all the time. They don't. Sometimes the times create them. Sometimes it's otherwise. It's very common to hear, well, all our great presidents were presidents in a time of crisis. Well, yes, most of them were. But not all of them. Theodore Roosevelt is a wonderful example to contradict that thesis. There was no crisis during Theodore Roosevelt's presidency. I guess some of the people might have said he was the crisis, but he was a very great man and a very brilliant political leader and public servant. I think what comes through more from the period of the revolution and the creation of the country is not that they were ideal, not that they were superhuman or gods. They weren't. They were human beings. And they each had flaws, weaknesses, failings. They all made mistakes. Washington in 1776 made some horrendous mistakes, almost finished us off. But that they never quit. They never quit trying to do their best. And their willingness to serve the country is the real example they set. That's what we have to get back into American life. I think our advantage is not only that they weren't perfect, but what they did wasn't perfect. We are work in progress. The United States of America is work in progress. It's the continuing experiment. We are left with the responsibility to try and make it work even better. More justice, more equality, more fairness, and so forth. And that's our advantage. If it were all handed to us on the platter, that wouldn't be very good for anybody. Yes, ma'am.
Hello, my name is Erica Madison, and I'm the executive director of the Massachusetts Caucus of Women Legislators. And I'm interested to hear your thoughts on who are some famous female figures from history who haven't been written about much, and do you have any plans to write about them? Thank you.
Oh boy, am I glad you asked that question. there are at least 12 women in the book I have written who figure very importantly. Now, that doesn't mean that they occupy many pages, though some do. The first is George III's mother, who said, "George, be a king." George III, by the way, is a very misunderstood man, much maligned. He is an interesting figure. He wasn't the mad King George. That came 20 years later in his life. Tragic situation. He was a patriot. He was duty-bound. He was a wonderful musician, a very good artist. He assembled one of the greatest public personal libraries ever in the world, in history. He's an interesting man, and if you do nothing but read the first few pages of this book, I hope you'll get that point. Catherine Greene, Nathaniel Greene's wife, extremely interesting. Lucy Fluker Knox, Henry Knox's wife, who was the daughter of a Tory, who braves everything. Martha Washington, who came here to Cambridge and stayed in the Longfellow House. That's another ghost you might find at the Longfellow House. Abigail Adams. I think Abigail Adams is one of the greatest Americans who ever lived, and certainly one of the greatest writers who ever lived. Mercy Warren, one of the first historians we ever produced, and who wrote one of the first histories of the Revolutionary War. Then there's other women who are extremely interesting, like Elizabeth Lloyd Loring, who was General William Howe's mistress and was the wife of a very prominent Massachusetts man named Loring. There was Dorcas Griffith, who ran a low grog shop in Boston, who was known as John Hancock's discarded mistress. Margaret Draper. Now think about this, Margaret Draper. I have come away with great interest in the Loyalists. I think they're an extremely interesting story. Margaret Draper was the editor of the Massachusetts Gazette and Boston Newsletter, which was a Tory paper, a Loyalist paper that kept on publication in Boston during the siege, all through the siege, and she took over the paper at the death of her husband and kept right on doing it. She was one of those 1,000 people who sailed away with the British on evacuation day. Mary Lindley Murray, who was Mrs. Robert Murray, who had a place, who was a Quaker, who lived on where Murray Hill is now in New York. And she supposedly, it's a lovely story, she supposedly offered tea to the British generals when they were chasing Washington and stalled them long enough for Washington to get away. She probably did offer them tea, but it wasn't her feminine wiles which slowed them down. They didn't have any intention to hurrying anyway. Molly Corbin. Molly Corbin was from Pennsylvania, and she went to war with her husband, as some women did. And she was beside him when he was firing a cannon at Fort Washington during the siege of Fort Washington in New York. And when he was hit and killed, she took over and manned the cannon until she was hit, nearly lost her arm, but survived. So, yes, there are many women who were involved, and there are many of them that I admire and enormously, and I wish we knew more about them. The problem is that very few, comparatively few women, as in comparison to the men, wrote the letters and diaries that we're dependent on. And that's what makes Abigail Adams such a remarkable figure, because if she'd done nothing else but write the letters she wrote, she served her country in a grand fashion. Yes, sir.
Hi, my name is Steve Jerome, and I hope you'll allow me to leave 1776 for a moment and just ask your opinion of the disclosure of FBI agent Felt as Deep Throat.
Well, I don't know what to say. It's certainly a story. I'm bothered a little bit that he was a member of the FBI. If he wanted to disclose what he knew, why didn't he turn it over to somebody in the judiciary, with the law enforcement? I mean, why turn it over to the press? I'm troubled by the fact that he wanted the job and didn't get it of running the FBI. It's too rich at this point for me to dare venture a conclusion. Thank goodness that all that did come out. But why would he give the story to Vanity Fair, not to the Washington Post? I mean, really, I don't understand a lot of it. It's a big story, and it's certainly valuable for history. One of the things I like to say is that too many people think that history is something that happened far away, long, long ago and far away. And we are all walking, if you will, on hallowed ground here. And history is not only under our feet and all around us, but it's also happening every day in the life that we are living. And the problem is that it's hard to fathom what that might mean. Harry Truman used to say that you had to let the dust settle for about 50 years before you could really see things in proportion and in balance. And I think that's pretty good advice. I can't wait to read more about this story.
In line with your discussion about history, since that things aren't inevitable, regarding the revolution, were there any thoughtful figures in the British government, cabinet members, MPs, who saw the possibility that, well, maybe we shouldn't push them too hard, and that perhaps in the end, instead the revolution could have been prevented, and perhaps America would have ended up Commonwealth like Canada or Australia? Yeah.
Well, we came much closer to being something like Canada than most people have any idea, because it truly was almost over about four times just in the course of 1776. Yes, there were people, most notably Edmund Burke and Charles Fox, in the Parliament, who spoke out passionately, eloquently, memorably, in support of, in expressing their understanding and sympathy for the American position. However, even they referred to us as our colonies. They were not about to give us up. Could an accommodation have been reached? After Bunker Hill, I'm not sure that would be so. What would have been the consequences later on? Well, as there was an English gentleman who reviewed my book for the Wall Street Journal, and he has the theory that if we'd somehow patched things together and made up and got back with the British Empire, that there would have been no First World War or Second World War, because the Germans wouldn't have dared to go to to war with the British, knowing that the United States would come in immediately because we were part of the British Empire. Interesting theory. I'm not very good at what if. Yes, sir.
Hi, my name is Victor. I was a merchant marine for a long time, and I traveled, and I felt at home in every place in the world. And before I have a question, when our founders wrote the Constitution, and they held the Constitution in the left hand and the slave whip with the right one, or when Andrew Jackson said the sub-race must be exterminated, referring to the Indians, and we end up putting them on concentration camps and starving to death, did this set hypocrisy as a form of government? Did the public hear one thing and see the other and say, fine, that's the way it goes? That prevails to today, because today the world thinks we are hypocrites. Actually, polls say that we are as popular as probably the world was against Hitler 7 years ago. So, my link is, there a link between that example and accepting these two things? It's like a child and a father. If a father misbehaves and the kid sees it, he probably thinks it's okay. You find a link on that?
Well, I don't really know what your question is, but let me try to answer it anyway. Yes, hypocrisy was glaring in the contradictions that persisted again and again. There were people founding anti-slavery societies who owned slaves. There were, needless to say, and keep in mind that slaves weren't just in the South, they were everywhere. There were people who went to church regularly, believed in mercy and doing unto others as we would have others do unto us, who were perfectly willing to go and slaughter Indians if need be. But alas, and evermore, that's the human condition. Read Shakespeare. It's because we have high ideals doesn't mean that we are perfect. Because we are human doesn't mean that when we do something noble, that too is human. Don't just say that we're human because we have failings or because we are hypocritical. We are often capable of doing very grand and noble things, as we continue to do still today. People who get all worked up about how things are just, going down the drain, the fervor over the independent judiciary. We've had an independent judiciary since John Adams fought for it, for the Constitution of the Commonwealth of Massachusetts, which I hope you all know is the oldest written constitution still in use in the world today, and it was voted for, not in this building, but in this parish, this church. That's where it happened. And certainly the people are going to challenge the independent judiciary, or they're going to tread across the, but we're not going to give that up. Just as we have insisted on rules, laws, which violate our deepest principles in times of crisis. Lincoln canceled habeas corpus through the Civil War. Franklin Roosevelt's administration put 110,000 Japanese Americans in camps, more than 80,000 of whom were American citizens. Terrible, a violation of our best principles. But in every case, after the Alien Sedition Acts, after laws instituted, emergency laws instituted during the Wilson administration, during World War I, all of them. Every case, when the crisis was over, we went back to our better and regular selves. So I think that we should be careful how worked up we get over these things. Pendulums swing. That's what pendulums do, they swing. And what seems terrible today, very likely cannot look so bad tomorrow, and we'll be worrying about the exact opposite the day after tomorrow. Yes, one more. I think we have time for a few more. Yep.
Last night I saw your interview on the Charlie Rose Show, and it was a very enjoyable hour. Now, in the interview, You said that whereas George Washington was a great leader, he wasn't necessarily a great general. In fact, he had relatively little experience being a general.
Yes.
And yet he was successful. And so my question is, who advised him on the tactics and strategy of warfare? Did he have some key advisors, and if so, who were they?
Did you all hear the question? Washington, among Washington's greatest advantages was that he learned from experience. Experience had been his teacher all through life. He was on his own from age 16. And I can't think of an example where he didn't make a mistake that he didn't learn from that experience. He had no brilliant advisor. The most seemingly brilliant general in the Continental Army at the time was Charles Lee, an Englishman who had joined the American cause. And Lee was an eccentric, extremely ambitious, many people feel, and I'm tempted to say dangerously ambitious man, who probably knew more of tactics and strategy than Washington did, and who could see the problem quicker, more, the solution to a problem more quickly than Washington. He saw immediately, for example, that to defend New York was impossible if you had no control over the rivers and the harbor. In other words, without sea power, you can't hold this place. But Washington learned, and he learned as he went along. And he saw, he was had a very good eye for ability. He saw in Nathaniel Greene and Henry Knox that these were two young men of extraordinary ability. And they were New Englanders, and he heartily disliked New Englanders. He thought that the New Englanders were dirty and unruly, and they had this awful idea that they should think for themselves. But he overcame that bias and saw in Knox and in Green the ability that he was looking for. And Knox and Green were the only two general officers who stayed with Washington all through the 8 years of the war. The only two, these two New Englanders that he picked out at the very beginning, the first summer, 1775. Yes, sir. Next.
May I just interrupt for a moment and say that Bernard has asked Mr. McCull have time to sign his books, that perhaps the last question can be asked by Mr. Little, who is at the end of this line.
My question is, in doing your research, what are some things that surprised you, things you didn't know, either in terms of information or in the character of some of the individuals that you found out about?
Well, it certainly surprised me that George III was as attractive and interesting a man as he was. I went to London, I saw the library, I saw the paintings he did, and it was very exciting. I was fascinated and very surprised by Washington's avid, passionate interest in interior decoration. Nathaniel Greene just bowled me over. He's an amazing man and a wonderful writer. There's a scene where in one of the family accounts where his brother describes him sitting by the, had an iron forge in Rhode Island, and he was a big, strong fellow, but had a limp from a childhood injury, just as Henry Knox had two fingers of his left hand had been blown off in a hunting accident. Both of these men would have been excluded from military service as being physically unqualified in a later day. Also, I can tell you, if there had been polls published every day during the Revolutionary War, it would have been over right away. I was very, very taken with several British officers who were as able as can be and by the courage of the British troops. Boy, they were terrific soldiers, no question about it. Brave, tenacious, admirable. I thought that the escape from Brooklyn, which was really the Dunkirk of the Revolution, was one of the most hair-raising stories I've ever read. And it's a marvelous combination of both providence entering in dramatic ways that you couldn't put in a novel because no one would believe it, but really happened, and the character and ability of John Glover and his Marblehead fishermen. The men from Marblehead, one of the best units in the whole fighting force, those people were the ones who amassed that makeshift armada and got the troops, 9,000 troops off of Brooklyn in the midst of night across the East River to turbulent currents, because it isn't really a river at all, it's a tidal strait, and without losing a single man. And to have navigated that, to have done that, was absolutely brilliant seamanship. Those boats were so loaded, they brought off all the horses, the cannon, everything. They were about 2 inches, the gunwales were only about 2 inches above the water. And then it was Glover again who took Washington across the Delaware. That interests me tremendously. Yes.
What if the winds had been in the British favor on August 29th and George Washington had been captured? What would have happened?
If George Washington had been captured?
Yes.
Yes.
Yes. If the winds had...
Well, if George Washington had been captured, and he was nearly captured several times, he lost it. He lost his self-control at Kips Bay. He had saw hundreds of his men running like rabbits, cowards, in his view. And he just lost it. He started using his whip on people. He pulled his pistol on some of the officers. He rode very close up to the enemy lines, much too close. He could have been shot. He could have been captured. It was only when two of his aides were able to grab a hold of the bridle of the horse and pull him off the battlefield. If he had been captured then, if he had been captured at Brooklyn, I think the war would have been over. I think he would have been taken to London and put on trial. And that would have been something. Whether he would have been hanged is a very debatable question, because if they wanted truly to have us re-enter into the family, so to speak, and return as part of the British Empire, I don't think they could ever have hanged him. And incidentally, at the end of the war, when Washington relinquished his power, Washington was a political general. He was picked as the general not because he was a great military man. He was picked as a general by his fellow members of the Continental Congress because they knew him as a man. They knew him as a fellow politician. And as a politician, he never, ever forgot who was boss. Congress was boss. And we are blessed again. We've been blessed with our political generals, our George Marshalls and our Dwight Eisenhowers, Colin Powells. They are the best. That's the kind of general a democracy should produce. Anyway, when the war was over, he relinquished his power to Congress, gave it back to Congress. And there's a marvelous painting by Trumbull of that scene hanging in the rotunda in Washington at the Capitol. Maybe any of you have seen it. Well, when Benjamin West, who was an American painter who had become the court painter in London, told George III after the war was over that Washington might do this, George III said, if he does that, he will be the greatest man in the world. So there was an underlying respect for Washington that makes me believe they never would have hanged him. They would have tried him, and they might have hanged a couple of others. They might have hanged Adams, for example. And there was a list. It wasn't very long, and Adams was one of them. Yes, ma'am. Thank you.
One question, just let someone else ask a question.
Hi, my name is Melissa. Hi, my name is Melissa. I'm a textbook editor at a publishing company, and it's really an honor to be here today and meet you. I'm working on a series of biographies and of people in America's past right now, and just wondering what the biggest challenge you've come across in your career as a writer and how you've gone through it.
Well, I'm very glad you're working on a series of biographies. There's a great need for biographies for young people, grade school as well as high school. I think the greatest challenge is to make it as interesting as it really was. You don't have to trick it up. You don't have to use little ways of making it interesting. Just say what happened accurately and with a feeling for the humanity involved. C.S. Lewis, I mean, excuse me, C.S. Forster, in his book on the art of fiction, gave an example of the difference between a sequence of events and a story. In a sequence of events, if I say to you, the king died and the queen died, that's a sequence of events. If I say the king died and the queen died of grief, that's a story. So don't just write with the head, write with the heart too. And good luck. Yeah.
Hi, David. Rennie Little, retired director of the Cambridge Historical Society. Perhaps a final question here closer to home. We in Cambridge have been brought up on the notion that Washington took command of the Army of the Colonies under the elm tree here on our common on July 3rd, 1775. What does your research suggest really happened?
Well, it's been commonly said that scene never happened. And I can't say whether it did or it didn't, but I can say, knowing Joseph Hodgkins as I do, that he is totally trustworthy. And in one of his letters to his wife, Sarah, he describes the military welcome that Washington was given, and much parading around and drums rolling and marching about and so forth, which he thought was perfectly wonderful and appropriate to welcome in the new commander. Whether this took place under an elm or not, I don't know, and I don't think it's important. I think what's important, and this comes through in everything that people like Knox, Green, and others wrote too, that they really welcomed George Washington to take command. And they were thrilled by him, and everything he did, all of his manner of leadership, they approved of. And George Washington had never commanded an army in battle before in his life, at 43 years old. But he had a clear idea that a leader should look like a leader. He should dress like a leader. He should have self-command as well as if he's going to expect to command other people. And they saw that in him immediately. The army that was here had no uniforms. They looked like homeless people. They did. They looked like ragged farmers in from the field. And so when Washington came into town in his magnificent uniform, riding a horse, the greatest horseman of the day, according to Washington, too, with Jefferson, riding a spectacular horse, one of those blooded Virginia horses. He was really a sight to behold, and it had huge effect. It also is interesting to realize that because he was as wealthy as he was, and they all knew it, he was reputedly the richest man in the country, which he was not by a long shot, but he was quite wealthy. Because he was so wealthy, that enhanced his spell over them, because their feeling was, if this man who has so much is willing to risk everything in the cause, who are we to hold back? Thank you very much.